My name is Adam Levine.
Yo, this your man, Kirk Franklin.
Hello, everyone. I'm Erica Campbell.
From London, England and Washington, D.C., you are tuned in to Conversations with Allison J. The Journey to Here, brought to you by Ethel May Books. This is Conversations with Allison J. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Conversations with Allison J., The Journey to Here. Today, as always, we have another captivating and thought-provoking topic and guest. Here's your host, Allison J.
Hello and welcome to Conversations with Allison J., The Journey to Here. I'm your host, Allison J. Today, we have with us Baz Dreisinger. Baz founded the Incarcerations Nations Network and is also an author of a book with the same title. The Incarceration Nations Network is a global network and think tank that supports, instigates and popularizes innovative prison reform efforts around the world. She also talks to us about the school to prison pipeline, a subject that many find provocative, but we need to talk about. We need to expose some of these things that are truly a reality for many. Baz, welcome and thank you for joining us on Conversations with Allison J, The Journey to Here. I watched 13th. For the first time, I think the day that I reached out to you, because I had heard of it, but I was trying to not bury my head in the sand, but I just didn't want to hear too much about the reality of things, because growing up in the UK to Jamaican parents, historically, I know a different history.
Mm-hmm.
And I've moved to the US 8 years ago. And so what I like to think that I don't stay ignorant to things. So I have been educating myself. So I had heard of 13th and I put it to be one of those things that I will get round to watching. So about a week or so ago, I was watching a few things and that came up and I says, okay, now is the time for me to watch it. And To say that the sad part is it just gave me more meat to the bones of what I already knew.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things as well is because there's so many things that people think are just a US problem. It's just unique to the US or US specific.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you were speaking and I thought to myself, hold on, this isn't just a US problem. This is the same thing in UK, in the UK, in Europe. And so I wanted to reach out to you because me personally, I think every single person alive should watch 13th personally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I agree. Of course.
But I wanted to talk to you and to get your take on it, and firstly, what led you to even do this, to write a book on it, to speak on it? What happened? What led you to this area?
Mm-hmm. Well, so I think it's a number of things, and I write about most of them in my book. I grew up as a native New Yorker, so I've been exposed to lots of kinds of peoples, and I grew up in the hip hop generation in the Bronx, and there are Jamaicans in my family and Peruvians in my family, and so it was naturally that sort of like growing up in multicultural London, right?
Yeah.
I was writing about hip hop and race and American culture and reggae music and other Caribbean musics for some years since my early 20s, really. And in graduate school, when I was pursuing my PhD, which was in English, I specialized in African American studies. I wrote a dissertation, which became a book about race and American culture. Specifically, it was about racial passing and kind of racial identity in the U.S. historically and now. And doing all of that just sort of naturally led me into the mix of touching on issues of criminal justice and prisons and race and justice in the country. And what actually led me into prison specifically was getting letters from people who were reading my work. And I was asked to come inside and do a talk by an education. It was a Latino organization that was organizing education in prisons. And kind of a lot of things coincided. I also had a friend who was in prison at the time that I was visiting. I was working on a couple documentaries about rappers and the criminal justice system and then rappers in prison. So all these things kind of converged. And then around shortly thereafter, I landed at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, where I teach. And while I was still engaged in all of this work and going into the prisons, by this point, I was a volunteer, an educational volunteer. And I would go in every chance I got to just give talks and also bring other people, smart friends of mine, with me to also give talks and meet the incredible men that I was encountering at that time. And it just became my life. I became incredibly passionate about the issue. And that led to my starting the prison to college pipeline and then writing the book and then. So one thing sort of led to another. But what it really fundamentally comes down to is that from the very first time I entered a prison, it just did not make sense to me on any level that this was how we were responding to harm in our communities.
Wow. That's it's fascinating what you just said there. From the first time you entered a prison, it didn't make sense to you.
Yeah, and it still doesn't. And I feel the same every time. I've now been in, you know, prisons in more countries than I can count. And there's never a time where I walk in and it doesn't. I don't have that same exact feeling of what the hell are we doing here? You know, even over and above just, of course, the, you know, the feeling of being empathetic to human suffering. But over and above that, there's just a feeling of how does this make sense? For whom, you know, does this make sense? And why would we respond to harm with this sort of warehousing of human beings? And why are we denying ourselves? I mean, the first time, again, I went to prison in New York, I thought to myself, my God, I feel so sorry for us and for us as a community, because the attitude was, I feel sorry that we are depriving ourselves of the best and brightest human beings. You know, and that transcended my feeling, any feeling of sort of empathy or sympathy I may have had for the incarcerated people. I felt sorry for us as a society that we were losing out on this level of talent and brilliance and sort of commitment to betterment. Mm.
And so, because I know that some people are going to say, but they're criminals, they deserve to be in prison. But do you think the prison system even works?
Well, absolutely not. And to that, I would say, I mean, you know, number one, the bulk of people in prisons all over the world whom I've met are many of them, yes, have committed crimes. They've also, in many respects, been conditioned for crime by racist and classist systems and structures. So let's not, you know, be over individualistic on this and blame it on the person committing the crime solely when particular individuals, people of color around the world, people in poverty around the world have been mass criminalized by systems and structures. So we always have to keep that in perspective. And then as to your question about whether this works, of course it doesn't work. If it worked, America would be really safe, wouldn't it? I mean, all we do is lock people up. I mean, there's no reason to think that if you just take people who are coming predominantly from traumatized environments and deprived communities, put them in further traumatized environments and further states of deprivation for X amount of years, and then dump them back out without giving them, you know, any kind of assistance in a world that's discriminating against them intensely, Yeah, sure. That's going to make us safer. What sort of fool do you have to be to think that that would make us safer? Independent of just, you know, having empathy for other human beings, like logically, it doesn't make sense as a system.
Wow. And it's one of the things you said, that they have been conditioned.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how so many of them end up there. I mean, can you elaborate and just talk to us about that? What exactly does that even mean?
Well, if you grow up in the context of racism and poverty, right? So where a state is not funneling any resources into your community. So that means your schools are terrible. It means there are no jobs. It means you are discriminated against left, right, and center in terms of hiring. And this is not only, it is of course heavily racialized, as in African Americans in the US and Maori and in Australia and New Zealand and Aboriginal folks. And so, yes, certain groups, but also in terms of just poor people, when we think about the global South and Southeast Asia, various African nations. So here are people who have, for not just, you know, a couple of years, but for centuries, been designated as others, and whose communities are deemed not worthy of funding and supporting. And where it's, you know, almost normalized to be poor and to not have. And then we expect people to act in superhuman ways and not engage in, say, crimes of poverty, to grow up in the context of extreme violence in communities, and then not be somehow transcend all of that and just be nonviolent. It's just a lot to ask of a person, and it's a lot to invest in the idea of agency. I mean, I'm not saying I don't believe in free will. There are choices that are made, but I believe very heavily in the context of choices that are shaped by our cultural context, our racial context, our class contexts.
And so speak to us about the school to prison pipeline, because I know I've worked in the corporate world I've only ever worked in the corporate world, and that's been for more than 20 years. And I had a conversation a couple of weeks ago with one of the senior leaders. And before moving to DC, I worked in Florida for 8 years, being at this company for four. And so now, in light of the George Floyd murder, diversity and inclusion is the big buzz in all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I was asked to help, and I thought to myself, great, being the only person of color in the room. So they mentioned to me, she said something to me, and I says, I'm very much aware that in the six offices across the state of Florida, I'm the only person of color. And she's like, no, yes. And then, you know, they took a step back and stopped and thought about it, like, oh gosh, yes, you are. So how does that make you feel? And I said to her that, well, to be very honest with you, if you speak to, I would say, 98% of black people or people of color that have worked in the corporate world, there has come a time when they have been the only person of color in the room. And we have just gotten used to it because we've had no choice but to get used to it. So I say all of that to say this, talking about the school to prison pipeline. If a senior leader can be so oblivious to the fact that in an entire state, there's only one person of color, then does it not stand to reason that I'm sure there's so many people that have come up to you and spoken to you and completely just don't believe the school to prison pipeline? How do you explain that to somebody?
Well, I mean, yeah, to your point, there is an outrageous amount of naivete that frankly, I mean, I suppose because my world is not really populated by folks like that, it's a surprise even to me, the level, you know, sort of the level of ignorance, frankly, of so many white folks in this country, and globally. Mm-hmm. And that all is coming to light now and in all kinds of ways. And I suppose that's one thing about this moment that I do feel very optimistic about is that at least there is a consciousness rising, and there are, you know, in books on the bestseller list now that I never thought I would see on the bestseller list, and that I'm thrilled to see on the bestseller list. And I hope all the people at your company are being made to read and get schooled in all kinds of ways. And so I think, you know, when you think about the school to prison pipeline, that it's just recognizing that young people, again, as I was talking about, you know, certain communities that have been designated as communities that are not invested in and that are not cared about, that have been almost created as funnels directly into the prison system. A lot of that starts in the school, where you have, you know, we're talking about defunding the police. Now you have police forces running security in schools, so that very, very young, I mean, we've seen a lot of these videos come out in the past 2 years too. You see little girls, little black girls, little black boys being, you know, handcuffed in school at the age of 7, 8, and then funneled into all kinds of systems and structures that are going to further criminalize them until they're old enough to end up in the system, in the official, you know, prison system. And that is just one of the many mechanisms. I mean, when you over police communities, that's the community to prison pipeline. Mm-hmm. So everything in communities that have been designated as, you know, othered communities, and they are pipelines directly into the system, from the schools to the blocks, to the level of what is being called now e-incarceration, electronic incarceration, where you have outrageous numbers of people in communities wearing ankle monitoring devices, and there are cameras everywhere. So you're just, you know, now we've turned entire communities into prisons. You don't even have to technically go to prison to go to prison. You just have to be from certain communities. In New York, we talk about million-dollar blocks, you know, the where the money being spent on policing and incarcerating people in certain very particular neighborhoods and neighborhoods of color, are costing millions of dollars. So it's all part of this nefarious web of pipelines into the criminal justice system.
That is so interesting, because I suppose, again, being from the UK, not when I was at school, we didn't have things like school security and school police. So it's something that I never saw, was never aware of. And even down to watching the documentary 13, again, history that I was taught was different. I had no idea that is pretty much how it started. So if you could explain to those listening what, because there's going to be people in the UK that have no idea what we're talking about when we keep mentioning 13. So if you could please explain, what is 13?
Sure. So 13th is basically an Ava DuVernay incredible documentary that came out a couple of years ago, which I had the honor of being interviewed by Ava herself for. I consider that like maybe the greatest honor of my life, because she is, aside from being just a genius filmmaker and a gift to humanity, she is the most rigorous interviewer I've ever encountered. Her level of scholarship, she could easily get away with asking people for sound bites, but her level of scholarship was mind-blowing. So, and it's a documentary that is very clearly, unequivocally creating a picture that shows us how slavery led to Jim Crow, led to mass incarceration, the direct line between slavery and mass incarceration. And in a nutshell, it's really this idea that after slavery, there was a need in this country to find ways to continue the social oppression and social control, and also economic control of African Americans. And so what happened was, en masse, you had newly freed African Americans criminalized via all sets of codes, what are known as the Black Codes. So essentially just breathing as a Black person could get you arrested, really. I mean, loitering, other kinds of things. And that funneled people directly into the criminal justice system. And then it gets into what has been called famously in this country in a book, The New Jim Crow, by Michelle Alexander, which is kind of a pair with Michelle Alexander is heavily featured in 13th, of course. And it's a really critical pairing with the documentary, which is a book about how what then became Jim Crow or segregation was another way of extending mass incarceration and creating a new class of second-class citizens, so that it was not about color. It was about being formally incarcerated and being of a lower class by virtue of being formally incarcerated and disenfranchised by virtue of being formally incarcerated. But we all know that numbers-wise, who is getting incarcerated? The black and brown folks in this country. And so they became this new, that was the new Jim Crow. And so 13th as a documentary lays all of that out in a way that is just, it's undeniable. And even for someone who has never thought about this stuff before, it is a film that has vastly changed attitudes and understanding of history in this country. And I should say too, I mean, you were talking about the UK and obviously the work that I do is global, and I love the UK. I have many dear comrades and friends in London who I do this work with and have collaborated with on all kinds of things, and have learned from immensely. Akala, who is, you know, a rapper, philosopher, yeah, writer, thinker, is like family to me, and has I've been privileged to be schooled by him on many, many things. And I recommend his book too, Natives, definitely an amazing read. So all that is to say, in places like the UK, there is a similar history, except it's around colonialism as opposed to slavery on the land itself. So it was more about empire and the idea of, you know, colonizing others and enslaving people, but on other shores, who then came over, right, and were discriminated against upon coming over in all kinds of individual and systemic ways. And I've been heartened to see that as the U.S. in this moment is confronting its hideous legacy, its founding upon genocide and racism, we're seeing this happen globally as well, including in the U.K., including in Australia, including even, on the continent and confronting legacies in the diaspora of colonial justice and colonial policing, and how all of these things are still being played out. And so this is a moment of reckoning on a global stage as well. And in fact, I when I was in London last November, we had an Incarceration Nations Network launch there in partnership with the Criminal Justice Alliance, who's one of our partners in the UK. And Afua Hirsch, the incredible, also philosopher, writer, thinker, British Ghanaian, mm-hmm, she interviewed me at that event, and we had an amazing conversation about, you know, the U.S. criminal justice system, the U.K. system, legacies of discrimination, and I said to her that there should really be a U.K. version of 13th, and someone really should make it if it isn't already being made. I mean, I hope it is, because there is a similar story to be told there that's screaming to be told.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if you heard of the last couple of years, what's been going on with the Windrush generation.
Yes, yes.
So that's very similar to what's been happening. All these people of color were brought over with this whole promise of this better life. And then fast forward now, 70 years later, people that were born in the UK that never went to any of the islands, but because their parents were part of the Windrush, they're now being told they're not citizens, and they're just trying, the way that they're trying to literally just round people up and ship, mm-hmm, off to a country that some of them have never been to. Some of them have left so many years ago, they don't even know anybody in these back in their country of birth anymore. So, mm-hmm, so you're very right when it comes to like the similarities. I mean, fortunately, the atrocities that have been experienced here with lynchings and to some of the other things I have seen haven't happened like that in the UK. But then if we think about what used to happen in I think his name was King Louis from Belgium in the Congo.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it may not have happened in the UK, but it was happening in extensions of the UK. It was happening in Barbados, in Little England, as it was known, right? Mm-hmm. It was happening in Kenya and Ghana in all kinds of ways. And systems of mass incarceration and prisons were developed in those colonies to, again, further oppress and find ways to subjugate the natives, you know, even after slavery. So it may not have been happening on that soil, but it was happening in the name of that soil, in the name of empire elsewhere. And those legacies, again, are still being played out.
Yeah, and you know, if we think about the most famous of them all, Nelson Mandela, were in prison for, was it 27 years?
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I think we're still trying to figure out what did he do, why he was in prison for 27 years. He shouldn't even have been in prison for 27 hours, much less 27 years, because it was just baseless.
Absolutely. I actually saw an article on CNN about Prince Harry and Meghan Markle coming out and calling out the legacy of colonial empire in the UK as something that needs to be addressed. And gosh, I don't know that we would have expected to see that a couple of months ago. So the reckoning is global.
And it is. And one of the things I don't know him personally, would absolutely love to, but Prince Harry, he's always been that more outspoken one, very much like his mother in that sense. And to know that it's now being seen and it's being called out is actually very encouraging, very refreshing. But my fear or concern is that, you know what it's like when somebody of that stature starts to speak out, everybody then starts to belittle him. And I see how they've been using Meghan to do that.
Mm.
If he had married a nice white girl, would it be the same? Because, I mean, the racism that she experienced when they were dating, and to the point where he had to come out and I can't remember if he read it or wrote a letter to the press saying, look, you people hounded my mother to death. You'll do the same thing to my wife.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My fiance at the time, they weren't married. And just the way that they behaved towards her and the way, and the hatred, some of the comments that I read after I've read an article about them, the level of hate that is aimed at her in particular, it just makes me think, is it because she's a black woman? And of course the answer is yes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Of course the answer is yes. So it's, and I'm just wondering if Harry seeing that is what has opened his eyes more to the fact of, as you mentioned, that, you know, he's calling out colonialism and things like that. I mean, what do you think to that?
I hope so. And I hope that it can translate into something more than just them making some comments, you know? And I think that that's the way that I'm feeling in this moment overall. I am all for this, you know, this new racial consciousness. I'm all for companies like yours and other corporates requiring people to go to webinars and read books and see 13th. And I'm all for all of that. But I'd like to see it translate into systemic change and real policy change. And so is that, you know, for instance, are Meghan and Harry going to come out in favor of reparations and really push to see that happen in a real way for the former colonies? Are they going to push for the dismantling of this entity known as the Commonwealth, which is an old colonial remnant?
Yeah, yeah.
So where is the action? Where is, you know, in the US, I started a Medium column in the pandemic, and I wrote a piece calling for a US Truth and Reconciliation Commission and a new constitution. The US Constitution is a joke. It is dated. It is ineffective. It is racist, right? The reason 13th is called 13th is because the 13th Amendment does not abolish slavery as people claim it does. It abolishes slavery except in punishment for a crime. So it allows for mass incarceration as the new slavery. And we need a new constitution. The most progressive constitutions in the world were written relatively recently. So South Africa, Germany, We need a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. There's starting to be some movement on that here. And that, of course, needs to be go hand in hand with systematized reparations. So let's translate this into action. I mean, we've also, at Incarceration Nations Network, we've just started our Defund the Prisons campaign. There's a lot of talk about defunding the police, which I support fully. But we also, going hand in hand with that, is a defunding of the prison system. So if you look on our social media, and we're Incarceration Nations Network on Facebook and Incarceration Nations on Instagram, we started laying out 13 immediate steps that can be taken to defund the prisons, and then 6 long-term abolitionist steps to be taken that can move us really into a world where we don't need prisons, where we can build safe communities and have accountability and have genuine opportunity and equity without this evil system that involves the warehousing of human beings, and specifically the warehousing of Black and brown and poor human beings.
That would be a dream, because I know firsthand of a lot of people that look like me that are in prison and serving years for something that, like, their white counterpart would have either got thrown out or suspended sentences and things like that. So it does give me hope to think that there are people like yourself that's really just raising awareness of this and they're not staying quiet.
Well, yeah, no, I think I think we're lucky that there are, you know, I'm not some lone voice in the wilderness by any means, that I, you know, there's a whole movement of people who have been pushing for this and continue to be pushing for this in serious ways. So, I consider it an honor to be part of that community globally and to do my small part in lending whatever voice to it.
That's great. And honestly, Baz, you're doing more than a small part, because there's so many people that would be too afraid to speak up and to speak out about these things. And you mentioned earlier on about books that everybody should read, and some books that you said that you are pleasantly surprised to see on the bestsellers list. Can you tell us some of those books? Because I'm all for people just educating themselves about these kinds of issues, because we can't ignore them anymore.
Yeah. So there's been so many great book lists put out now. The New York Public Library, an institution that I, as a native New Yorker, always support, put out a pretty good list. I would recommend checking there. But Ibram Kendi is his books are at the top of the bestseller list now, and that's incredible. How to Be an Anti-Racist is so important. The New Jim Crow, as I mentioned before, is another one that's getting loads of attention in a great way. So I would take a look at the lists that have been put out, take a look at some of those titles to start with. But there's so much to be, educated upon. When They See Us is another documentary by Ava about the Central Park Five. I would also recommend the documentary on that subject. Four Little Girls, a Spike Lee documentary. That's at least 10 years old. That film is necessary. Who Shot Malcolm X, the Netflix series about the movement and also about the killing of Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. God, the list goes on.
I noticed you didn't mention your book though.
Incarceration Nations.
I'm late, okay, she's gonna mention her own.
I like my book. I'll say that. I do like my book. I wrote it. I stand by it. So I recommend Incarceration Nations. It is, I still very much think of this in a global context. And so I'm always, even though I'm born and raised in the US in New York City, I consider myself someone who lives in the world. And so I am always seeing these issues in a global context. Because as you mentioned earlier in our conversation, it does tend to often, I mean, Americans are great exceptionalists and they're very good at shutting out the rest of the world and just pretending that our issues are our issues. And they're not. And we are not unique in our legacies of racism and oppression. And we're also responsible. I mean, one of the premises of my book is that we are, to a great extent, responsible for mass incarceration around the globe because we developed and exported this model. The modern prison system was developed and built in the U.S. and was then foisted on the world via colonialism and globalization. And we still, as I continue to see as I make my way around the world doing this work in a global context, we still have our hands in pushing very bereft systems of justice on the world. And that includes prisons, that includes certain legal systems, plea bargaining, right? The idea of desperately taking a plea bargain because you're being held in an awful jail for lengths of time, because you don't have a good lawyer, because you can't afford one, because you're black, brown, poor, et cetera. Yeah. That, and then you just plea bargain and end up going to, that is something that's being foisted on the world. And also, colonial legal systems, the British legal system has been exported to all of these former colonies in ways that do not benefit the people and do not fit for those communities. Especially, I think, we were talking about Jamaica earlier. Jamaica is still governed by a colonial era legal system that is not really relevant to a place that is very community driven, where restorative justice and other kinds of community justice make a whole lot more sense given everyone knows everyone, right? So, so why this, this formal legal system that is, again, cut and pasted? I call it cut and paste justice because that's what we have. And by we, I mean, the empires of the world. So whether it was the old British Empire or the current American Empire, we are cut and pasting and foisting this on the world.
Well, that is so interesting that you should say that. And like you said, people just like to be in their little pond and just don't want to raise their head above to see that, that things are happening in the rest of the world. Because people like to be comfortable and live in their little cozy place. So I'm just grateful that you, again, people like yourself, and you mentioned Akala, are out there doing these. And where can anybody find your work? Where can anybody find out more about what you guys are doing in the movement?
Sure. So the Incarceration Nations Network, we're incarcerationnationsnetwork.com, and you could sign up for the mailing list and also check out, there's a lot of information on our website about some of the things we've just been talking about, including our Defund the Prisons campaign. On Instagram, Incarceration Nations, I'm Boz Dreisinger on Instagram as well. And on Facebook, Incarceration Nations Network. And definitely I encourage people to, share and download the Defund the Prisons campaign, the very specific asks that we're making in this moment. And also, be in touch with us if you see if you're listening in another country and you see these as relevant. By no means do we think that there's no simple, here's the answer anywhere. But we definitely don't think that the calls to action here are necessarily applicable everywhere. So we're encouraging our partners all over the world to figure out what their demands are and be in touch with us in order to elevate them and amplify them. That's what we do. INN is really about supporting our partners globally. We have partners all over the world who are doing this work often against the grain of public opinion. And we're just trying to get their voices heard, get their, get their needs met and support them and cheerlead for them as much as we can.
Great. Thank you. And just on a final note, with all the work that you are doing, if we were living in an ideal world, what would you like to see happen?
Well, in the abolishment of prisons, genuine equity, and frankly, I don't like to use, you know, I'm not big on terminology because I think terminology skews our perception of what something is, but collective ownership, a version of a redefined socialism for the 21st century, that when we use the word community, we're really talking about communities. We're really talking not just neighborhoods where people are disconnected and not being served as a genuine whole. So collective ownership, true equity, and all of that naturally leads to a world without prisons.
Right. Raz, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been a great conversation.
It has been. Thank you. And I just want to end by saying that the key here is for us to really educate ourselves about what is going on. We need to know what is making up this world and the world we live in and the world that we're leaving to our children. So it's no longer enough for us to just live in our own little bubble, live in our own little neighborhood, and just not be concerned with what's going on. These are serious times that we're living in. So please, as Baz has said, there are books out there you can read. There are movies, documentaries, I should say, that you can watch to be educated. There is no excuse anymore for not being aware. Baz, I thank you so very much.
Thank you. Keep doing your thing.
I will do. Thank you. Take care now.
Thank you for spending time with us. We're already looking forward to the next episode of This is Conversations with Allison J. The journey to here. Until next time, honor, respect, and blessings to you all. If you want to connect, visit AllisonJ.net. That's AllisonJaye.net. Allison with one L, as she is the one and only.